Hi, everyone. This is Sean Dubravac from Avrio Institute.
And I'm Ross Rubin from Reticle Research.
Thanks for joining us again for another week of our podcast. Today, we're going to dive into the Google hardware announcements that took place this week. We'll hit on a couple of other things as it relates to the future of the smartphone. And we'll maybe dive in for just a minute about some developments taking place in the travel industry and how that might change the way we book travel in the future. But let's start first with the Google hardware announcement. Ross, when I saw the announcement here from Google, I really was expecting an entire portfolio of products to hit the market. I'm really shocked by the restraint that they showed, only launching two phones, a tablet, and then, of course, the Google Home Hub. What was your initial thoughts? Were you expecting more product? Did you think it would be a relatively limited portfolio like we ended up seeing?
Yeah, I'm not surprised that you were expecting a broader portfolio. I think that's what a lot of the build-up to the event would have led us to believe. We certainly saw a broad lineup last year. One reason I think that it may have been a bit more limited this year is that Google is in the process of integrating Nest with their hardware group. That's something that's been on and off happening over the years, and that was most evident in the Google Home Hub product. We can talk a bit about that and how it differs from the other smart displays, but that kind of integration challenge may have forced Google to focus a bit more and have less bandwidth for some of the more fringe devices we've seen from them in years past, like the Clips camera that was not updated this year. But it was a pretty core lineup. Maybe we could start with the Pixel phone, because that was certainly everything, something expected by everybody. So what was your take on Pixel phone, the new Pixel phones?
Well, I think for me, it opens up these very big, broad questions of what is Google trying to do with their hardware. Obviously, they're selling a small fraction of what other Android partners are selling. They're selling a small fraction of what Apple is selling. At the same time, it feels like they could have done a lot more with this device, but they didn't for whatever reason, and perhaps they want the premium products to come from their partners. They seem to go back and forth. Sometimes they want to have the premium product and show that the top-in-class reference design product, and other times they seem to step back from that leadership role. I was surprised to not see facial recognition or iris scanning technology. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the things that I was surprised to see missing. But again, with this Google launch and with the Google portfolio, and they even joked about it at the announcement, they had leaked these across the board. I even saw that they were being sold in Hong Kong a day or two before the launch. So their communication strategy here was a little all over the place.
Yeah, that could be taken as a sign that they really didn't have anything revolutionary in the works for this year, in the spirit of one more thing, as those announcements tend to come in. Regarding the Pixel, you know, if the idea was to show off their AI promise, their AI prowess, I think they achieved that to some degree. I think they did a good job of showing how their work in AI informed or helped the product, both through the use of the camera, which is a beat that the entire industry has been on in terms of how AI can help smartphones take better photos. But probably the coolest feature that was shown was this call screening. And I think it was very much in the spirit of the Google Duplex demo that we saw at I/O, their developer conference earlier this year. So with Duplex, Google can make calls in the background to set up certain appointments. And the idea is to allow us to avoid engagement for mundane tasks. And here, it's a little bit of a different angle, and it takes place apparently on the device. But The idea is that the agent can answer the call for you, ask the speaker what is the call about, let you know about it, and then you can decide whether you want to take the call. So it's very much in this spirit of having the phone do stuff for you as opposed to you necessarily having to interact with it, again, particularly for mundane tasks. So those were, to me, the killer features of the new phone, hardware-wise, and they even hinted at this at the beginning of the presentation, probably not as as impressive as what we've seen from other top competitors. And to your point about who takes the mantle, is it the first-party company in the case of Google, or is it a third party? I would say that in the case of Google and Microsoft, which has also been straddling this first-party, third-party game, in general, I think the first-party companies want to go out with premium products. I think more often than not, that's what we've seen. It's certainly what we've seen from the Surface group at Microsoft, and all the products that they introduced, Google introduced, they talked about the design. They talked about how, particularly with the Pixel Slate, they are using these high-resolution displays, and they need that if they're going to compete with the best from Apple and Microsoft, which is the goal.
So why don't they do more with this then? You know, Google's only sold about 5 million Pixel smartphones over the last 18 months, according to IDC. Apple's doing that many in about 8 days. So if this is really the top of the line reference design product, you would think that you would cram everything in it. I do agree with your point on AI, and I've got some comments on that, but why not do more from a hardware perspective then? Why not put everything into it and really set the mark for what a smartphone could be? And it also seems like that would position them wonderfully against Apple, where they say, this is actually the premium product. And maybe it's got a $2,000 price point, and so they're not selling very many. But I would argue 5 million over the last 18 months isn't very many either when you're talking about
sure.
a global smartphone market.
Sure. And, you know, maybe I think at least some of it comes down to distribution, right? So Apple, in addition to having a strong presence at all the U.S. carriers, which they've built up over the years, you know, being in the game for so long at this point, has its own retail stores where they can really highlight the devices. And of course, it's become a cliche now, having people line up for the new iPhones when they're released. The for Microsoft, you know, they are maybe not killing it in the consumer PC market, but Surface sales, particularly at the high end, where they are going very aggressively after, say, the iMac, have been growing. They've been, and part of that is because they have strong channel ties, particularly into corporate market, into the enterprise, and so that's what has been responsible for driving a lot of the Surface Pro sales. Google has the weakest retail ties of those three companies, and that's probably one of the major reasons why we haven't seen the Pixel phones pushed more aggressively. That said, you know, it's tough. Android is a very competitive market, you know, even more competitive than high-end PCs where Microsoft is trying to make inroads. You know, they're certainly not the only Android maker, despite what you would think are some, you know, very key advantages, that has struggled to make some headway against Samsung.
To your earlier point on artificial intelligence and AI, I do think that is a strength for Google, and I think they're trying to highlight that strength in these products, and I think there'll be more to come. And I think if you look at the history of smartphones, you can see that we constantly redesign the experience we have on these devices by launching these new services. So it was the original iPhone that introduced visual voicemail. And if you can remember before then, mm-hmm. you used to have to dial up your voicemail to it to see right. what it, you know, what it was, who called, if you had a voicemail, what the message was. And then with the original iPhone, you could see that you had a message and you could listen to it from the device. And then, of course, later on, they introduced text-based translations of that and transcriptions of that. And so you're able to actually read it there. I wonder, though, if we need more than that. Is seeing it enough? Do we need somebody doing call screening? I don't know if you caught it from this week. Ironically enough, Paul Romer, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in economics, didn't answer the phone when the Nobel Committee called him because he thought it was Pam at first. And so after the voicemail, after he heard the voicemail, then he called them back to accept his Nobel Prize in economics. So there's clearly a problem here if the Nobel Prize winner is not even answering his phone because he thinks it's spam.
Committee shouldn't have spammed him so much in the past, you know.
Right. So maybe call screening is a great feature. I just wonder if it really is something that's going to resonate with us, or maybe it's a broader sign of moving into a more automated world where we're automating more services on our behalf. And you see that in other announcements. One of the announcements from this week was that the Essential Products phone from Android creator Andy Rubin, probably your brother, right, Ross?
No relation.
They're trying to figure out what they want to do next. And one of the things they're looking at is a phone that would text responses on your behalf, so automating some of the interactions that we have. So maybe the broader focus for where we see AI in these devices is automating some of those areas. I definitely think there's some great opportunity in the photographic capabilities of the device, and you saw them look at a variety of different approaches from capturing moving objects to low light settings to other things like that. So there could be some really interesting applications in photography. And again, it becomes integrated into the service. It's happening in the background. And so you don't even necessarily have to explicitly make the decision. And I think that's where AI from an automation standpoint will really make sense.
And I think, just getting back to the competitive dynamic, it's going to be interesting to see where that AI innovation takes place. You obviously have Apple and Google investing tremendously in this. You have to think that a lot of that is going to find its way in at the platform level. And so it raises the question, how much freedom, how much flexibility will the vendors have in adding AI capabilities? How much of a differentiator will it be, particularly if, and I agree, as you say, a lot of it's going to happen in the background. And speaking of platforms, I want to get back to the Google announcement a little bit. And it's interesting in that all three of the products that they launched are on somewhat different platforms. And to me, one of the more interesting ones was the Slate, which marked a reimagining, I think is the word Google used, of Chrome OS. Up till now, almost all the tablets that have come out beyond the iPad and Surface, if you count Windows devices as tablets, certainly there have been some, have been running Android. And Google kind of took a swipe at that in introducing the Slate and saying, this is kind of a real desktop operating system that runs a real desktop browser. It's not a smartphone operating system, trying to just blown up onto a bigger device. Obviously, they're taking a swipe at Apple and the iPad with that, but they're also taking a swipe at their partners, such as Samsung, even though a lot of them have fled the field of Android tablets. So, what do you think is the implication of that? What did you think of the Pixel Slate?
Well, definitely to your point, there it's coming head on to the Apple iPad Pro, and trying to really compete with that. It's got a much heftier price point than you would expect from traditional Android-based tablets. And you could argue that Android-based tablets, mm-hmm. many of them, for the most part, flooded that low price point. And so that in and of itself should help this as a productivity platform, because it sets a higher price point, it sets a differentiated user experience. You know, it has a $99 stylus if you want. And so I still struggle to identify what's the clear use case scenario. I see clear niche use case scenarios. I see market opportunities at certain levels, but I don't see the type of volume coming into a category like this, like we see in smartphones or like we see in PCs and laptops. It seems to fit within this narrow niche group, and the use case scenarios that we've long touted haven't really materialized.
I would agree. I would say the Pixel Slate faces a number of obstacles. First, as you mentioned, general softness in the tablet market. And Chrome OS is in something of a transition right now. You ask who the user is. Well, certainly a lot of the users have been K-12 students, where the school board has bought Chromebooks, inexpensive Chromebooks from, say, Acer, en masse, and distributed them. They are, very well suited to that purpose. Whereas Google has been one of the very few companies, again, releasing very high-end Chrome OS devices, going back to the Chromebook Pixel and the one that they, the 2-in-1 that they released last year. So while Chrome OS has changed a lot, we should remember that the core of it is still that web experience. And here they're talking up apps, which are Android apps. And, even though the Slate may not be running Android, the apps are still limited to assuming they're on that environment. So on one hand, it's something in their favor that they have all these touch-friendly tablet apps, or at least touch-friendly apps from the smartphone world. That presents it as kind of a better theoretical tablet experience than, say, what Surface can provide today. But but those apps are not really optimized to the experience. They seem to indicate that they're now working more with OEMs to try to beef up those apps. So I would say the other thing in terms of this product and looking at Google's two operating systems is that for a long time there's been talk about the two of them converging, and it seems to me that Chrome OS is just creeping more and more into a smartphone-like world. So perhaps at some point, we will see Chrome OS-based phones.
Yeah, and that wouldn't surprise me, especially if some of these tablet-type products take off. I do think that Chromebook market for the K-12 audience is a great fit. Low price point. You're seeing classrooms K-12 migrate to Google Classroom, and so having mm-hmm. a browser only device fits very well with that, and that's something I've noticed over this school year, is that you're seeing classrooms really migrate away from some of the other platforms that they were using, Blackboard and other things, for example, to Google Classroom. And so the low price Chromebook market, I think, will continue to have a place in that K-12 market and some other areas. Maybe at this higher price point, it does start to creep up, and eventually over time does migrate to a smartphone chassis, if you will.
And maybe at the at a Microsoft event last year, there was a similar dichotomy where they introduced all these low-cost Windows laptops for the education market at the same event that they introduced the Surface laptop, which is a premium product that they aimed toward college students and staff. And maybe the idea here is that with a growing number of students, being comfortable with Chromebooks, being comfortable with the cloud, the idea to have something for those students as they start moving into college and the work world and, you know, want something a lot sleeker, you know, that may follow, even if I think we would agree there's been a very small market for Chrome OS outside of education to this point, certainly on the high end.
But I think everybody eyes that K-12 market as the gateway audience to get your product into a greater, broader marketplace. So I think Google has seen it at different times. Apple has even seen it at different times. Microsoft clearly sees it. Can we get a product, maybe it's a lower price point, limited use product, into that K-12 market that then hooks that user to that platform, and then we carry that on to higher price point products as they move on. And maybe that's what this product becomes. Maybe it's not this mm-hmm. year, but in years to come, if you have a cohort of K-12 students who have operated in a cloud-based environment, they're extremely comfortable with Google Docs and other Google products, they grew up in a Google Classroom environment, they're very comfortable with that collaborative approach to editing and content production, and they want a higher priced, higher performance product, but they still want something that's Chrome OS. They want something extremely portable because they're working in coffee shops and other remote type of environments. This could be the perfect product for that audience. Again, I still see that as a pretty well-specified audience. So, and whether that's the mass market, you know, will remain to be seen.
Yeah, I think, you know, for the tablet market at large right now, there is a sense among the major brands that this is kind of the future of where computing is going, right? Even when Apple introduced the iPad, they talked about it being the first, you know, or yet another post-PC product. They talked about it as being kind of the PC of the future. And so, you know, certainly in the consumer market, the volumes may not be there, but I think that they all, you know, Apple, Microsoft, and Google are all positioning these products as forward-looking, you know, more avant-garde, people ready to move behind a lot of legacy, people who need to do more work on the go. And until that market, you know, becomes dominant, a lot of it is going to be enterprise sales and at the high end. And we've certainly seen that with iPad Pro and Surface Pro.
And maybe we continue to see more of that, though there is a whole host of Word documents and Excel documents still have a strong presence in the enterprise. And so being able to easily...
And Microsoft, that's a good point, right? So there is no native Chrome OS Office. Will Microsoft build it? Can they build it? Certainly, you know, the relationship between those two companies is not great, but maybe there's an opportunity there. And speaking of apps, that's also a segue to the Home Hub, where it's one of these new home screens that really is not very app-based. So now we've seen a number of these things, these smart displays, released over the past few weeks. There was an update to the, or announced update to the Echo Show. There was Facebook's portal device, and now there's the Home Hub. And it seemed to me that they all kind of have a little bit of a different focus, which is not surprising in the early days of a category. What was your take on Google's approach and how it compares to what we've seen from the other companies?
So I really like Google's approach here, actually. And I think that of the four products announced, or five if you count their wireless chargers, that this was the most interesting product. This was the one that I pre-ordered from the suite of products that were launched. And I think there's a broad storyline taking place here. First of all, it's really interesting to think about how we're transitioning from what was a audio voice enabled experience and just smart speakers to something that now has a screen. And we've gone through this transition before when we went from radio to TV. We took a radio experience, we brought it to the screen. At first, that experience was very similar, but over time, the screen changed the experience. And so to me, the biggest mm-hmm. questions become, how will including a screen in that smart speaker category really change the experience? Is it just a visual display of some of the information being shared? So when I set a timer, I can also see the timer on the display. Little things like that, I think, are actually very useful and very helpful. I think Google sees this product, at least initially, residing primarily in the kitchen. And they demoed some recipe approaches and some recipe use case scenarios. So something as simple as seeing the time, I think, is really interesting. Clearly, video will have a key role with the Google Home Hub because it plays YouTube videos. And I can definitely see kids pulling themselves up to the counter and watching videos right on the display. And so that's a unique differentiation that they have over some of the competitors, because Google isn't letting YouTube play natively in some of these environments. You're having to go through the browser. So I think that's a really interesting opportunity. And I think there's definitely further opportunity for commerce. Voice commerce is not a great experience, and it hasn't really caught on. Granted, it's an extremely new category from a hardware perspective still. And the idea that we'll just start to order things by saying what we want and cross our fingers that what shows up is actually what we wanted. It's all of that is still very, very new. But I do think having some of that visual information displayed is very useful. So shopping, airline tickets. Today I can order airline tickets in some of these voice worlds, but it's not a great experience. So being able to just get confirmation of what I was wanting and ensure that it heard me correctly. I mean, you see this in fast food chains today where you walk up and you order something with your voice, but then they display the information on the display for confirmation. So being able to confirm what you're getting, I think, is a really interesting approach. And they've taken a very different approach than some of the competitors. First of all, it's $80 cheaper than the Echo Show. So I think that's telling what they're trying to do. It's a 7-inch display, is something bigger. And so I think it's a really interesting product. It shocks me that Apple hasn't mounted an iPad mini to their speaker and tried to drive into this category. I know that wouldn't be the Apple way, but they've got all of the components and it's intuitive to their users. It would seem that it could really drive into that space. Obviously, that would be a very app-based experience. And to your earlier point, I think you're wanting to see this platform move away from an app-based experience because you want it to be a more intimate computing experience. You want it to play in the background and be reactive to voice prompts.
So, wow, a lot to unpack there. I mean, first of all, I agree with you. It's a very interesting transition. I would say that, of course, we've had multimedia tablets for a long time. And what really sets this apart is that, given that it originated out of the smart speaker space with the Alexa Show, it's an audio-first experience. You mentioned a number of examples where you could use the visual display for confirmation. But there are other applications, and again, Google did not hesitate to really highlight the use of YouTube, which has been a very sore point for Amazon with the Alexa Show. We even saw devices like this a couple of years ago, like the Sony Dash, but they didn't have this audio hook, and so I think it creates a little bit of tension actually, because the smart speakers were introduced to be these ambient devices that you didn't have to focus on. That was sort of the whole idea, right? Because you had your smartphone, presumably always within reach. And so this is to create interactions where you don't have to be looking at a screen, sort of what they're predicated on. And now they're adding a screen. So And also, I think your comment about Apple is very interesting in terms of the app experience, saying that, sure, there are benefits to moving away from an app-based experience to these types of products, but I would have thought the same thing about smartwatch. And in fact, when Google first introduced Android Wear, it wasn't a very app-centric model. And then Apple came in with the Apple Watch, and it was a very app-centric model. And for Apple, I think a lot of the keys to this expanding family of devices is to expand the footprint for developers, the ones that have been supporting the iPhone, and a lot of them are kind of extensions back to the iPhone. So an interesting dilemma for Apple should they decide to participate in this space. I certainly understand what the applications are for a smart speaker, and interestingly enough, they really haven't been very broad, right? So there's a lot of requests for basic information, news, weather, stocks, etc., and music, again, not surprisingly, a leading application. So is there potential value to the display? Absolutely. And, you know, you provided a couple of good examples. But is it a natural augmentation? In some circumstances, for sure, it makes a lot of sense to say an alarm clock, you know, bedside kind of companion. You mentioned the kitchen. But there's also, I think, a little bit of tension in that the category was originally designed to be something that you didn't focus on, and a screen detracts a little bit from that.
I agree with that. I agree that they still want it to be an ambient device, and I think that's why they show those initial use case scenarios being in the kitchen, because if you think about the way you operate in a kitchen, you're pretty much fixed within a relatively confined area, and so having information display, whether it's a recipe or a timer or some other things, could be interesting. And I see it as an augmentation of what's happening in the audio space anyway. So I might ask for information, it may display it, and then I may or may not turn to that.
Mm-hmm.
In that type of scenario, it's an augmentation and it's additional information that the consumer can use or not use. Similar to saying the time and having the time also displayed. So if I didn't quite hear it, I might be able to look at it or request it again. To your point about apps showing up in the watch, I'm still not convinced that that's the killer approach to developing use case scenarios for our wrist when it comes to internet connectivity on our wrist. I think what we always do in the tech industry is take what's worked in the previous iteration and drive it to the next iteration. So when the internet was browser-based on your computers and we took it to the smartphone, the early focus was always on the browser. And we talked a little bit about this. Apple, in their first announcement of the iPhone, talks about getting the full web, not a watered-down mobile web, but the full web. And so they were really focused on a browser experience. And you can still remember the browser wars of the early smartphone world before things were really locked down in app environments and app store environments. And so we take what's working in the smartphone and start to drive it into these new areas like wrists and watches. And so we focus on that. So I think what's interesting here in this Google Home Hub and in the smart speaker screened category more broadly is that you're starting with that voice experience and then adding the screen to it. So how will that start to change the use case scenarios? Except when you come to YouTube, which again, I think you're going to see kids just pull up and gravitate to the screen and sit there and just watch it for 2 hours without blinking.
That's a good point in that it is kind of what you see on the device is kind of device specified in many ways. It's not so interactive, even though, you know, a lot of these devices have touch screens. And in defense of the early generations of these products, I think Amazon has done a good job in designing the visual accompaniment that you see when you interact with an Echo Show or an Echo Spot. It has been complementary. But the question ultimately becomes, how much value is it adding? And will a lot of those scenarios that you mentioned broaden the applications that you can do with these agents? One of the main challenges is that Alexa can do thousands of things, and discoverability is really bad. So that may be the challenge that they need to solve before a lot of these screen-assisted applications really, really shine.
Yeah, I think it is a massive experimentation. We saw it start with Amazon, where they tried a couple of different screen adaptations to their smart speaker, one more designed for the bedroom in the case of the look, the show kind of showing up in these more shared spaces like the kitchen. And so I think there is a lot of experimentation. Certainly one of the things Google does is lower the price of that experimentation from a consumer standpoint by $80. And so now you can explore it and try it out. And whether it drives some of these other services, retailing and commerce being the most noteworthy of those, remains to be seen. And to your point, maybe it's something entirely different that shows up, or nothing at all, and it always remains this secondary piece of information that's second to the core of that audio experience.
And just maybe to wrap on the Home Hub, a couple of other, I think, interesting aspects to it. First, no camera. A big contrast to the Facebook portal, a number of contrasts to the Facebook portal, which is available in this massive 15-inch display size, whereas the Home Hub, as you mentioned, has one of the smaller displays at 7-inch. Amazon is also growing its display on the Dash, and I'm sorry, on the Echo Show, and a big focus on home automation, which leads me to believe that this device was perhaps incubated within Nest, and is now coming over. YouTube is a natural fit, but with the emphasis on home controls and home automation, it seems to be a very Nest-centric product. And that is a good application for it, although again, what is the installed base interest in that? Probably good for early adopters, but is it enough to really drive this product as opposed to some of the other Google Home products and gain some momentum, which to come full circle has really been the issue for Google devices.
Yeah, and I could definitely imagine scenarios in that home automation space, like smart cameras, baby monitors, things like that, where you do want maybe not an always-on experience, but you do want a quick look. Hey, Google, show me the the baby monitor, and you can take a look at what's happening, and then it fades into the background after you've taken a look. So I do envision maybe some new experiences around that home automation space.
Speaking of new experiences, maybe we could touch a bit on this new Essential phone that you mentioned at the start of the podcast. And this comes from the startup, new hardware startup, being helmed by Andy Rubin, who was the developer of Android, and again, is no relation. And also to an earlier point regarding the Pixel phones, the first Essential phone was a more traditional Android phone, very highly anticipated given the pedigree of its developer, and hasn't found a really hard time finding footing in the marketplace, just like the Pixel phones have, except even more so coming from a smaller company with fewer means at its disposal. So it seems like what they're looking at doing is not continue making traditional Android phones in the current model, but to create a new kind of phone with a smaller display that would focus on agents to handle different kinds of tasks for you. And in the article about this, which appeared on Bloomberg, The question was raised, how feasible is this? Because today, agents like Alexa and Siri struggle a lot with more complex tasks. So that seems to be, again, some of the tension at play there. But what do you think about this as kind of an industry direction and, you know, feasibility? Is this what consumers want?
So to your point, one, smartphone category is extremely competitive and has become extremely competitive. And so to enter that space and to provide a meaningful experience, you really have to differentiate yourself beyond hardware, I would argue. And that feels like the direction that this is trying to go. That when the hardware is commoditized, content becomes king, software becomes king, the experience becomes king. And so they're trying to figure out how to differentiate themselves in the market. And then I do think in a crowded environment of activities and incoming information that we do want to have some of that automated. And I think, again, that's where a lot of experimentation and exploration is taking place. What can we automate? How can we automate it? How can we streamline it? How can we make it seamless? And every company right now is taking a different approach on what seamless means. You know, obviously Apple, we talk about it all the time. Their seamless experience is being able to easily move from one product to the next. And it's a very similar experience, similar use case scenario, and similar user interface. Other companies that aren't beholden to that same platform, and you saw it in the Google announcement that we talked about earlier, they can come out and they can launch things with different OSs because they're not so tied to that single OS experience. Then when you look at Essential, they've got to come out with something that's differentiated from some of the competitors in a very competitive marketplace. So how do they do that? They look to create an entirely new experience. And they have the privilege of doing that because, again, they're not tied to a certain OS. They're not tied to a certain market share at all. And so they can really try very different things. And I think those are the companies that over time will really disrupt the marketplace because they'll introduce entirely new ideas. Now, the question also becomes then, can you take what's working there and employ it into some of these other platforms?
Yeah, I do think there's value to this. Remember earlier we were talking about the call screening, and I think features like that do resonate with consumers because they're about giving more of your day back. They're about dealing with less of the mundane that you have to deal with. And the key for this, I think, will be to embrace more of that kind of application of AI where agents just get stuff done for you as opposed to the more interactive, chatty manifestations that we've seen since Siri, where Samsung essentially tried that with Bixby, and there's been somewhat of a backlash. You know, how many of these things do we need in our lives? I don't need another agent to talk to. You know, I want an agent that just does stuff for me. And I think that there is significant room for AI to assist with those kinds of tasks quietly in the background where they can build value off that. You know, it's not going to be a holy grail, and it's not going to anticipate every need that you have, like, AI in the movie Her. but you know, can they get some momentum with this? I think so. You know, obviously it's still a challenge for a small company in a crowded space, even if they execute extremely well. But I think they can shift the dialogue literally by reducing the dialogue.
Well, and also they can create some IP and then become acquired, and that's been a previous exit strategy for Andy, and so that's the approach that they could take. I think to your point earlier about having it work in the background, that's something we've hit on throughout this conversation. Look at spam filters. And spam filters are a great example of artificial intelligence doing tasks for us. And there was a time where it wasn't a very good experience. And so we always went to our spam filters once a day, once an hour, once a week. And then slowly over time, the technology got better so that most of us today rarely go to our spam filters. Chance an email does get caught, we just have them resend it as opposed to trying to wade through our spam filters. So there's an example of automation working on our behalf to your point, decrease the dialogue. And you could see something like that work here. It's a matter of creating an experience that does accelerate the interactions and reduce the dialogue. That's where, you know, does call screening actually reduce the experience that I'm having, the time that I'm dedicating to this? That's the part that we'll have to see if that actually plays out.
And so going from a an experience that we barely might notice to one that represents the height of immersion at this point, Magic Leap, the highly touted augmented reality startup that just recently shipped its developer headset, had its developer conference and talked about a couple of really interesting things. You wanted to talk about the avatars that they showed off during the conference?
Yeah, I saw their human-like artificial intelligence Mica avatar, which just I think is incredible. They've done a phenomenal job of creating this artificial intelligent avatar that really looks lifelike, seems to have the type of movements that we would expect from a human, and really gives you a sense of the type of experiences we might start to have in these augmented reality and virtual reality environments. And so you could really imagine that this starts to look a lot like the customer service experience of the future or other applications. It could be a retailing experience of the future where we're doing some of that today with chatbots. Could you start to incorporate it into a human persona with something that you see visually in an virtual reality or augmented reality type environment? So you have this human-like AI that's trying to solve some problems you have. I think there's some really interesting use case scenarios. And I found the demo of Mica to be extremely compelling.
And one of the things that I saw as I tuned into the webcast that they had was a augmented reality web browser. You know, it became apparent that they are building just about everything from scratch for this platform, which probably helps explain why it has had an extended gestation period. But for example, it's running its own operating system called Luminos. So that is something new, and it has support for all kinds of, as you might expect, dimensional audio and other things you really need for the experience. But one of the other things it has is an augmented reality browser called Helios, I believe. And this, what it allows is for web developers to easily create objects that can inhabit the space that you're in. So they gave examples of things like a model of Tyrannosaurus Rex or, you know, dinosaur skeleton that you know like you might see in the Museum of Natural History here, just kind of hanging out in a conference room, and a, you know, giant whale swimming around, you know, a large area. And these things are kind of the equivalent of text and graphics and video in a traditional web browser, meaning that they're relatively easy to create, except instead of being limited to this two-dimensional screen, you can play in the real world, which is the whole idea of augmented reality. So pretty exciting stuff, very visually compelling, as your example was. And, you know, we'll see if they can get this thing into more consumers' hands.
Yeah, we'll definitely see how the launch goes. And again, I think this area is going to be an area where we see slow take up, moderate progress over time, and then it'll start in the gaming space, and then over time start to bleed into some of these other areas.
One other caveat I would add is, if you remember some of the early HoloLens demos, they looked incredible, overlaid onto a screen where the implication was that you were seeing exactly what the person wearing the headset was seeing, when in reality, the field of view for the objects is much more limited. So it's really not quite as immersive in terms of being this seamless thing that covers everything you can see out of the goggles. Instead, the objects would appear and disappear. So that's one example of the kind of limitations we've seen. There may be others for Magic Leap.
Yeah, I think there'll be. I mean, this is clearly an area where there's going to be a lot of experimentation and exploration and different trials. So there's a lot to come there. Let's close with just one quick thing I wanted to hit on. I this week spoke at Travel Connect, which is a travel industry conference hosted by the Airline Reporting Corporation. And a big topic in that industry is NDC, new distribution capabilities. You're seeing it as a new way of retailing, really, for the airline industry, as the airline has unbundled their traditional product, which was a ticket that included a seat assignment and a meal and even a deck of cards if you asked for it. You're really seeing them break that apart. And today, when you buy a ticket, you pick your seat separately, you check luggage and pay for luggage if you want. So you piecemeal the service together. Most of that has to be done with the carrier directly. And so this is a XML-based data transmission standard, open to third parties. You've got about 55 airlines that are using it, a number of aggregators, number of travel sellers, number of IT implementers and providers that are all buying into this new approach to drive more information and ultimately more products from the airlines to their travel partners. And so you'll be able to, in the future, book all of these accoutrements and other add-ons in an a la carte approach through your travel provider, whether that's online or offline, whether that's small or large. So you've got a number of airlines that have committed to moving 20% of their volume through NDC APIs by the end of 2020, by December 31st, 2020. So it's something that you're starting to see take hold now, and it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. And it's all about really the retailing of airline products and all the pieces that fit around this ticket. And so you could imagine bundling certain things together as part of that experience. I might buy a ticket from New York to San Francisco, and I want to add on an Uber or Lyft ride on either end. And so it becomes part of that bundle, and then it's coordinated there. So I could add things into it. I could maybe buy an economy ticket, but add lounge access. And so it's a way of mixing and matching these separate pieces and putting together. And more broadly, it really shows how this airline industry is moving to a more digital, datafied environment across the board. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out over time and how it creates more flexibility in the retailing of tickets and airline products.
In terms of more flexibility is generally good. And in keeping with some of the earlier things we said, it sounds like a Travelocity or an Expedia Orbitz would be able to, through, say, a voice interface, now be able to prompt you for things or respond to commands, perhaps, that it would not have been able to do in the current system. But I also wonder a little bit about the classic cable a la carte paradigm, where people think that they want to be able to pick and choose every channel so that they don't pay for anything they don't want. But in reality, very often, it just becomes very complicated. And so even companies that have launched over-the-top broadband services like DirecTV Now and Sling TV, et cetera, have core packages, in part because it's just very cumbersome to pick and choose everything you want. So I would say, I think you gave some good examples, and it's going to be incumbent upon the airlines to present all these options in a way where it just doesn't feel like you're being overwhelmed. I mean, sometimes I feel that way even under the current system, booking a flight, and it asks me if I'd like to add maybe half a dozen things that I generally don't have interest in.
Totally agree. I think one of the great challenges is, are we going to overwhelm the consumer with choice? And I think that's one of the great challenges of digital environments generally. When shelf space scarcity goes away and there's an abundance of options that can be merchandised, does the consumer then become overwhelmed with choice and not know where to go? And so that will be something that the airline industry is going to have to look at. And really, I think every industry is going to have to look at is how this broad digitization, which opens up flexibility, opportunity, choice, how that will ultimately feed back into the merchandising decisions of that industry.
Well, I think that may be a good note to end on. You know, over the past few weeks, we have had the luxury of talking about big announcement event after big announcement event, and now we're going to take a little break from that, or rather the industry will. We have a Samsung developer conference event in early November, but we'll see what transpires in the next few weeks. I'm sure there'll still be lots of interesting stuff to take on.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of interesting announcements, and as we move into the holiday season, those topics will move to top of mind for many of those in the industry. So we'll be watching some of those things closely. Again, thank you for joining us. I'm Sean Dubrovac. You can follow me on Twitter at Sean Dubrovac.
And I'm Ross Rubin. You can follow me on Twitter at Ross Rubin.